Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me very shortly is a dear friend of mine and a phenomenal chap in every regard, Julian Brigden of MI2 Partners. We had a conversation about the macro world a little over a year ago now. It was one of my favourite conversations of the year, and Julian's very kindly agreed to come back and do it again. So we will get into all kinds of parts of the macro world, and I'm reasonably convinced that what Julian has to say you will find absolutely fascinating, because every time I get a chance to talk with him, I come away feeling exactly that way. So without further ado, let's bring Julian onto the podcast. Well, Julian, mate, it's so good to see you again. It's been quite a while. It's been well over a year since we last had one of these chats.
It has been. Yes. What a year.
So, look, there's so much going on. And, you know, the biggest thing that everybody's talking about is the pivot. And I'm sure we'll come to that later on. But what I'm curious to start with you is just to get your sense with all the clients that you talk to and all the people that you speak with, what's the kind of top of mind thing that keeps coming back at you?
So I think, you know, and you can see it in the price action. I mean, the macro community had a very good year last year, by and large. You know, they tend to do very well when there's destruction around. And that was definitely, you know, 21 and 22 have been fantastic years. I think people are running quite low risk at the moment in general. Certainly immediate risk. I think there's some structural plays still on the books for further out, Grant. And we could talk about that in a second. But right here, right now, I think things were summed up well by one of my clients. He said to me, you know, I have 150 units of risk and I have 15 on.
Right.
And, you know, it's partly the time of the year. You don't stick your NADs on the line in January and February and then, you know, and lose them, right? Because that's the year gone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
right.
This is the time of the year where you take sort of chip shots. And I think there's a fair degree of uncertainty. And I think probably the prescient issue is, when is this bugger going to roll over and die, right? When is this economy going to roll over? In fact, you know, if I look at the title of my sort of running, and I always run a sort of constantly updated presentation, you know, just in case someone says, can I have your sort of 30,000 foot view of the world right here, right now? And it's termed, you know, are we there yet? That's the title, right? You know, are we there yet in terms of policy? So can the policymakers back off? And are we there yet in terms of the economy? And I think, you know, we've all looked at this and been somewhat surprised by the strength of the data. You know, what's causing that? I'm somewhat in the crappy seasonal adjustments, warm weather, plus what I refer to as hyperfinancialization. So in other words, the sort of basing of the equity market in October is already feeding through into some of these stronger PMI metrics. And I've seen quite a lot of people start to question, and people I really respect start to question the, you know, ask that question, could it be different? Because this bugger should be dying. But I think, you know, you're probably like me because you're the same generation. You probably watched every single Bond movie three times over.
At least, yeah.
So do you remember GoldenEye?
I do. With Xenia on the top.
Yeah, I was going to say, the second best Bond girl's name ever after Pussy Galore, right? So,
I would argue that Plenty O'Toole in was the other one where Sean Connery's line was, named after your father, presumably.
God, gone are those days that we could even get away with saying that. You'd go straight to jail if you put that into a movie these days. Anyway, so in GoldenEye, there's that sort of Russian programmer, you know, who's the...
what's his name? Boris.
Boris. Who's, you know, and anyway, so in that classic sort of last scene of a Bond movie, right, everything's blowing up, right? And Boris is burrowing away on his PC and everything around him implodes. And he kind of looks around and he realizes he's still intact. And he stands up and he says, "I am invincible," at which point the liquid nitrogen tanks behind him rupture and he's turned into a popsicle, okay?
Right.
And I have that feeling, Grant, when I, and I think this is the question that the clients are trying to ask, you know, just because it hasn't hit you yet, are you invincible? You know, is it different? Or is it just that you haven't got hit by the liquid nitrogen yet? And is it coming? And I think the more the risk that this policy tightening keeps going and the more that the data is distorted, not quite slowing yet, the greater the risk that at some point we will tip hard. And I know that the Fed is desperate to avoid the errors of the 60s and 70s. And one of the biggest errors was this move from nice, predictive policy. If you think about, you know, the economy as a sort of sine wave around a long-term trend of growth, right? So you got 1.75 trend growth or whatever the number you pick, right? And then you're a little overheating at the top and you come in, nice predictive policy, damp, you know, encourage it on the bottom. And you get these beautiful great moderation kind of periods of extended growth where nothing gets out of whack. And you go and look at the 60s and 70s, and it just gets absolutely, completely out of kilter, right? They are raising hundreds of basis points, and then they're cutting almost the same amount. And then the next time they're rising even more, and then cutting even more and even more. And to me, that was because they got essentially behind the curve, right? They kept policy goes from being preemptive to being reactive.
Yep.
And as a result, they actually exacerbate the cycle because they tighten too much. They start, you know, they ease too much on the other side. And in a way, you know, for market people, it's like trading negative gamma, right?
Yes.
They're paying the highs, they're selling the lows. And your position gets really, really out of whack. Like your P&L gets really, really badly damaged. And they're very desperate to do that, Grant. They've been incredibly desperate to not go back to that sort of volatility that we had. You know, stop-go economics, boom-bust cycles, everything that you and I as kids grew up with before 1985. And yet when I look at this, I can't help but think, that's where we could be going. I mean, I look at, you know, we joked before we got on the air about, you know, how do you receive Swedish swaps, right?
Yeah.
And the reason why I do it is I look at the Riksbank and they've got super hawkish. And I look at the underlying economy and some of my models are suggesting the worst recession in 30 odd years. And that's saying something because that means worse than COVID and worse than the global financial crisis. And I can't help but sit there and go, oh my God, this could be bad. And I think, so to go back to your original question, I think that's what clients are trying to figure out because the macro crowd looks at the equity crowd and they go, no landing?
Yeah.
What fucking planet are you on? Right? Just because the liquid nitrogen hasn't hit you yet, let's not forget, really, we've got to go another 2 weeks before it was a year ago that the Fed started raising rates.
Yeah.
Right. So these things work with a lag. And I look out there and I look at things like, you know, commercial real estate and private equity and a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, to use another film analogy, there are a lot of dead people out there that you just don't realize they're dead yet.
Yes. Well, it's fascinating. That Goldeneye analogy is really interesting because, of course, one of the conceits that went through from the very opening scene when Sean Bean was a goodie, spoiler alert, can you have a spoiler alert for a 1994 film? I don't know if you can or not.
Probably not.
To the end was this mismatch with the timers being set, but at a different time to the time that the guys thought. And when you bring this up and I think about it, It's so true, right? That's where we are. Because you stand up thinking you're invincible, but all the time behind you, there's this ticking going on that at some point is going to blow that nitrogen tank wide open. And, you know, when I have these conversations with people, the same as you, this idea of no landing, which has become kind of wishful thinking, but so many people seem happy to embrace it. And unfortunately, the feedback they're getting from particularly equity markets is that, hey, we might just get away with this. You know, we might. But it's that idea of hope not being an investment strategy, you know, because I spoke to James Aitken recently and we were talking about this and he said, look, you know, what I've been saying to people is, what would 7% Fed funds rate mean for your portfolio? And he pointed out to me that he'd said a year ago, what would 4% Fed funds mean for your portfolio? And people were like, well, we'll never get there because the system will break. Okay. And I think those are the kind of conversations that people need to be having in their heads. It's like, okay, I know it sounds wacky. Of course it sounds wacky. But what does this mean if they have to go here? Because everything I'm seeing is the Fed particularly and the ECB kind of playing catch up. Andrew's sentence is wobbling a bit now, but desperately grabbing the market by the lapels and saying, we really are serious. We really, really mean what we're saying. Please believe us.
Yeah.
What does it take for people to actually believe them, do you think?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, remember, I saw some fantastic chart the other day where, and obviously you and I are complete abject failures because this is not the case. You know, if you're a partner now in a hedge fund or a partner in a private equity firm, you started post 08.
Right.
Right. You and I should own them, right? Yeah. The fact that we don't means we're obviously abject failures.
Well, I've known that for a long time. Yeah, I'm surprised to hear about you, but listen, I'll take your word for it.
But you know, certainly after the divorce,
you're only half an abject failure now.
Half an abject failure. Is that a good thing or I don't know?
Well, it depends. To be determined.
Yeah, exactly. Only half an abject failure. But the point is we sort of sit here and we go, oh, we've got away with this, and it's all going to be different this time. And the Fed, to your point, and I think all these policymakers, to your point, I think the big one that got me was it a year ago, 18 months ago, when they, you know, you had Bank of England, you had Powell, you had Lagarde, you had Bailey, it's Sintra, you know, the ECB offsite, the Jackson Hole equivalent. And they all came out and they said, we are serious about inflation. Now, the big test, and I'm in the cynical camp in that sense, ultimately, the big test will become if we've still got sticky inflation and then unemployment is at 6%, and the politics, particularly in the US, as we go into 24 in an election year. But right here, right now, they are deadly serious. And I think, you know, part of the problem, I think, Grant, is we've had this self-supporting pricing between the bond market and the equity market. So it's not like the equity market is making assumptions which are unrealistic. They're looking at the pricing in the bond market and they're saying the bond market is assuming all the way up and then all the way down.
Yeah.
And, you know, the grand old Duke of York, as we would call it, right? So if that's the case, why do I sell my equities? Because I know at some point the Fed's going to be easing and this thing is going to come all the way back. What they're not understanding is the rationale behind the bond market's view. So the bond market, there's only two ways that kind of happens, that you go all the way up and all the way down. Option number one is inflation is just evaporates. Miraculous, you know, disinflation. And historically, that doesn't hold true. We did some work around this policy of opportunistic disinflation. We can talk about that a bit later, which is what I believe the Fed is trying to pursue. But the one of the criticisms of opportunistic disinflation when it was first sort of rolled out to the scenes in the mid-90s was that it could take a hell of a long time to grind down inflation, because even if you embrace the recession, the average, and the San Francisco Fed did a paper on this, the average decline in inflation from the start of the recession to 1 year after was 1.9% in terms of core CPI and 0.9% in headline CPI, 1.9 and 0.9 on core. Okay. So the point is very, very low gain. So okay, so maybe you can say, look, the bond market's pricing in a very rapid drop in inflation. It doesn't really pass the smell test. So if it isn't pricing in a very rapid drop in inflation, what is it pricing in? And then you say, well, must be pricing in a recession. And it must be pricing in a pretty severe recession. And that's obviously what the equity market doesn't understand, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not so that I think the pricing of the markets has been inconsistent. It's the misunderstanding in the logic that's driving both of those two markets. That's where I think things are out of whack. And I think now you could argue that, you know, even though credit repriced quite quickly last year, it was one of our better trades. We were short HYG for a long time, like from the start of 2022. You've really seen no weakness in credit based on economic weakness. It's just been, you know, just bond yields, just the duration repricing.
You know, that brings us back to this idea that, as you said, the partners in all these firms began in 08. If you think about it, when was the last time that interest rates were being used to combat inflation, right? They've been used as a tool to avoid market meltdowns for such a long time now that people assume that that's all they're used for now. It's like, oh, well, when the market gets squirrely, they'll cut rates.
Well, you've really got to go back to pre-98.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
To when the put was initiated, right? That was when we switched from inflation fighting to deflation fighting. And, you know, I always liked to, there was a fantastic paper that the Bank of England did. And I think, you know, it was in like 2010 or something, they put it out. And they looked at 250 years of correlation between equities and bond prices. And starting in 98, it flipped to being negative. But prior to that, it was always, always, Grant, positive. So in other words, bonds went down and stocks went down, right? Not what we've seen since Greenspan came in, where he came in and he sort of prioritized trying to support wealth and stimulate the economy and supported the equity market. And, you know, there's very, very few people who've been in that world where you've had a positive correlation between bond and equity prices, not yields, prices. So it's just a very, very different world. And I think we have to get used to that. I mean, I, for one, am firmly in the camp the bond bull market of the last 40 years is done.
Yeah.
I think we're moving, you know, it may not necessarily happen, but if you ask me to connect where I see the dots falling, I think we are moving into a period that looks increasingly like the late 60s into 70s on balance. Won't be exactly the same, but on balance, that's what I think it looks like. I just, you know, even my bloody girlfriend started wearing flares again, and I'm like, this is it. It's like, what the hell are you wearing?
You are now a man of a certain age. Don't get sucked into that.
I was like, how are we going to look? We look bloody stupid if you're wearing flares and I'm wearing skinny jeans, right?
Yeah, you need to go to the dad jeans, mate. Straight to Gap for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Elasticated waistbands, they're the way forward. Hey, so but listen, you know, it's interesting because this idea of this bond bull market being over is another one that's kind of taken up an awful lot of my thinking time. And I guess the kind of squirrely bit here again is we could absolutely see bond yields fall again. We get this recession that everyone assumes is baked in the cake. We see rates fall. We see bond yields fall. And you know what's going to happen instantly. Failed breakout. We're back in the channel. Here we go. We're going back to zero. And this is a continuation. But I suspect the flip is every downtick in bond rates is now against the trend. They're going to keep trying to pop back up again. And that changes so many things, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to think of something that you as an investor don't have to completely rethink about how you not only set your portfolio up, but how you manage the volatility in between there, because you're having to manage it from completely the other direction.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we talked about, you know, return to boom bust, right, as well.
Yeah.
You can have these periods where, to your point, you want to be max long fixed income. Now, there's a big difference, obviously, if we're in a bond structural bond bear market, when you get when you get the rally in fixed income, when yields fall, you sell them there, right? You sell them. Yes. And you're a seller on rallies of bonds as opposed to a buyer on dips, which you have been for the last 40 years. But the structural changes, to your point, are going to be profound. And this is why I think, you know, I talked quite a lot at a number of engagements and stuff, one recently where, you know, it was all sort of the luminaries of the business. So there was, you know, Posnar, Louis Gav, Pomboy, Danielle Di Martinez, myself, you know, a few people. And it was all a little frightening that we all end up talking roughly about the same sort of thing, you know, a really ugly recession. So then you get your rally in fixed income, but almost certainly met by, because of the politics, another stimulus round in sometime in 2024, which would not be received well by the bond market because you'd possibly get a gilt type situation that we saw, you know, recently, where you're like, you're in the shit. Your budget deficit's fucking huge. You're going to spend even more money and you haven't fully wrung inflation out of the system.
Yeah.
You know, and then at the same time, then you risk running into issues with currencies, you know, and what happens to the dollar and all this sort of thing. And, you know, Louis and I've talked about this and Posner was talking about this and Gav was talking about this, you know, these steps by the BRICS and particularly by the Chinese and the Russians to come up with digital sovereign currencies, right? And you know, if you want to be Machiavellian, and I don't want to be truly Machiavellian, Grant, but you know, is that the time when you get the gold back, you know, digitalized renminbi or whatever it is, right? And you cut the dollar out because you know this is big boy geopolitics, and the way you fuck up the sovereign power or the hegemonic power is you ding their currency. Well, that's what happened to sterling, right? I mean, people forget, you know, I looked at this thing about US defense spending and it was like, you know, bigger than the next seven countries. Well,
that's right. Yeah.
The UK Navy was bigger than the next three in 1914, right?
Well, and look, let's go back to that as a perfect example, right? Because at that point, the UK Navy was the envy of the world and everyone was afraid of the UK Navy and said, well, you know, as long as the UK has the preeminent naval force in the world, which is exactly what we're hearing now about the US. Yeah. And okay, it's a different time and the technology is different. I understand all that. But look at what the UK Navy is now. I mean, you know, it's a couple of punts and a rowboat, and that's about it now.
Yeah. Which they can't find men to fill, and they can't afford to put aircraft on the aircraft carriers. Right?
Exactly right. And you know, watching how the UK fell apart, particularly after the Suez Crisis, which involved the Navy in a significant way, that was orchestrated by the Americans, don't forget. You know, that was a very deliberate state of affairs that the Americans took their opportunity to essentially neuter the hegemon currency, and it worked beautifully. And it always amazes me that people are so convinced that that cannot possibly happen to the dollar. And I understand that it probably can't happen yet, but as you say, there are so many reasons for other people to want that period over. And so what I don't think people understand is if that happens and the dollar is even challenged meaningfully as the world's reserve currency, the chaos that unleashes is extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm highly skeptical that anyone in the Western world would want to put their wealth in, you know, renminbi, right? I mean, of a communist country. But, you know, you carve out and decent proportion of the world where you say India's kind of takes both, Middle East takes both, you know, Latin America takes both, Near Asia has no choice.
Yep.
And then, you know, suddenly there's quite a lot getting done in renminbi, even if Western Europe doesn't touch it, you know, even if North America doesn't touch it, and in that I include Mexico, right? It's still a very different world.
Well, it is. And you look at how quickly these Western countries signed on to Asian development banks. And, you know, if you look at how quickly the UK jumped into that, just we want to be a part of this because we can't not be a part of it. And at the very least, and this is what I keep saying to people, at the very least, it's now something that you can't not think about. It was for a long time. People would talk about this and you go, oh, yeah, whatever. But you can't just ignore it and say, it's not going to happen anymore.
I don't think it's prescient. I mean, I think it comes about from a process, right? It's we do get the spending, we do get the challenge to the bond market, we do put the Fed in a corner like they were in the late 60s, where they have to decide between supporting government, which is fighting probably three wars now, right?
Yeah.
Cold War with China, hot war with Russia, and climate change, right? Hugely expensive, Grant. You know, do they take on government and say, fuck you, here's where rates are, I'm going to strangle the system, I am going to choke out inflation? Or are they forced, because government's intent on getting spending and we've unlocked fiscal rectitude, as I said, has been taken out to the bike shed and shot through the forehead, right?
Yeah.
You know, do you, you know, are they forced to come in on the side of government, which is what they did in the 1960s? And, you know, in the classic statement of Bill Martin, who was the then chairman of the Federal Reserve, said, you know, the Fed is independent within government, but it's not independent of government. And they started to do QE in the late 60s in the Vietnam War. And that's basically led to the collapse of the dollar. It took a few years because we had a pegged exchange rate mechanism. But it's not hard to envisage in 25, 26 that we could get there. And you say, oh, that's a bloody long time away. It's two fucking years.
Yeah, it's no time at all. And look, the other interesting component of that is all these... Well, say all, the vast majority of these people who are going to be running are old enough to remember the damage to their votes that inflation does. So they're in a real pickle here because they know that, okay, we're going to have to encourage the Fed to let loose with lower rates and what have you. But they also know on a local basis, in terms of me getting reelected, if inflation is meaningful, we don't chuck that out of the system, I'm toast. They will just vote for the other guy.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of this return to volatility, right? You just get a lot of political volatility. You get a lot of economic volatility. I mean, just, you know, look at the return of strikes, right?
Yeah.
Right? Continental Europe and the UK. I mean,
yeah, the UK. I mean, last time I was back there, it felt like the late 70s again. You know, the ambulance drivers, the police are on strike, the hospitals aren't working.
Yeah.
It's really shocking. But what's shocking is how quickly this happens once it starts, right? And I don't think the US has quite seen it yet because the strikes are a little too disparate, but it's coming. Well, listen, let's talk about that opportunistic disinflation then, because as you said, this is what you think they've been trying to pursue. So walk us through that and how that works and what their thought process might be.
So essentially, look, you know, from my days when I was on the policy side, it was sort of a medley global advisors and all that sort of stuff. You know, we used to go and read the tea leaves when you go and talk directly to the policymakers, right? And that's how I got a lot of my relationships, which I still leverage, you know, these days. And, you know, I don't talk directly to policymakers, but I talk to people who do. And, you know, one of the things that's been plainly obvious is really the conundrum that policymakers are in, right? So to go back to that point, they really desperately don't want to go to that boom bust. They really don't, if they can avoid it, they really don't. They want to avoid the hard landing, right? Because they know the problems that comes with. Whether they can do that, Grant, I'm not certain. I think the longer the market fights them, the worse eventually it gets, right? The greater the odds. And I think it's looking pretty bad, to be honest. But anyway, we'll see. So there's only two options when you have inflation of this magnitude. Option number one is called deliberate disinflation. That's Volcker, right? You deliberately kill the economy to quell inflation, right? That's your boom bust. You want to avoid that one. If you want an analogy, you know, and I've said this to a few people, you know, you take the economy into the swimming pool, and you put your hand on its head and you shove it underwater till it fucking drowns, right? Dead. That's Volcker, deliberate disinflation. Option number two is called opportunistic disinflation. And opportunistic disinflation, if you go back to the analogy, means that you're in the pool with the economy and you push the head of the economy down into the water, not to the point that it drowns, it splutters. And then you opportunistically wait for one of two things to happen. Either, and this is obviously what you hope, and this is what happened with Greenspan, you get some sort of exogenous event, some sort of event, let's say a burst in productivity, which is what happened with Greenspan in the mid-90s. Yeah. And the level of the water essentially drops, right, through that improving productivity, which gives you faster trend growth, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't preclude the idea of the economy drowning. I mean, if it drowns, it gets hit by some exogenous, you know, you get something goes wrong in Europe, right? US goes into recession, half.
Yeah.
Right? But the point is, and this goes back to this, these research papers that were written about opportunistic disinflation in the mid-90s, that process, if you're not prepared to drown the patient, right, for all the reasons that we've gone through, and you are pursuing opportunistic disinflation, you have to be prepared to pursue it for a long time.
Yeah.
And this was the whole thing. This was one of our biggest views at the end of last year, coming into this year, that the market didn't understand what higher for longer meant. Right? They were like, what, we're talking 3 months? We're talking six? And the reality is, you're talking years. Alan Greenspan, if you go and look at Fed funds between the mid-90s when he got them up to sort of terminal rate, they basically stayed there for 4.5 years. You know, and if I said to you, you know, Fed funds are going to be, you know, we're going to get to 5.5, might just pick a number, 5.25, 5.5, whatever the number is, right? And then maybe they'll come down to 4.5, and then they'll sort of sit there till 2026, then people would have to radically rethink what this is all about, right? Because as I said before, you know, even if you push the economy into recession, which isn't a costless thing, a median rise in unemployment in a recession is 3.3% in the post-war period. So, you know, if we, that's almost getting you to 7%.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a soft landing. Grant, right? That is not a soft landing.
And certainly not coming into an election year.
No. So this is all very, very problematic. And I think people we've got so used to the market drops, the policymakers come in, they're the 7th cavalry, like they come round the corner and they save you, you know, and they kill all the Indians and off you go again, right? As the settler, they're on the side of the Indians now. Right? They are not your friend. They are your sworn enemy. You know, I kept tweeting this, right? They are not your friend, right? These central banks. And, you know, maybe at some point they will be faced with that dilemma where, because the bond market is revolting, because policymakers have spent money, do they fight them or do they embrace them? And that there will be then the decider whether this inflation truly is. We're in the late 1940s or the 1960s or 1970s. We haven't come to that point, but the shorts aren't going to pivot right here, right now. That's a farce. They might stop hiking.
Right.
But then they're going to grind you to death. They're going to grind that real estate market down. I mean, I look at housing stocks, you know, some of these home builders, they're not obviously in the home building selling business anymore, Grant, because you look at them against, you know, you can look at someone like KB Homes and it tends to follow new home sales pretty well and then Pulte. And up until this last thing, and then it just goes off again. They're like, oh, I guess they don't sell houses anymore. Then they I don't know what they do. They do something else, right? Because everyone assumes that it's just a flash in the pan, like everything has been since away. Immediate tiny bit of pain. It all goes away. We all get back to being making money and it's all nice. And I just don't buy that one iota.
No, I'm with you. And the other thing that, you know, I think people are forgetting to think about, if you put yourself in the shoes of these central bankers for a minute, and if you just said to them a year and a half ago when they were stuck at zero with no chance of getting off zero, if you just said to them, look, I can give you 5% rates without breaking the economy, they would have bitten your arm off. And I just think that the chance of them giving this back again quickly, they're going to begrudge every 25 basis points they cut from here.
Right.
Because I think they realize we can't ever get down there again because we're completely trapped down.
Well, I think that's partly why they want to avoid the boom bust thing.
Yeah.
And I think the other lesson of the old Fed president wrote quite a lot about opportunistic disinflation, and he talked about, you know, how this essentially works. And essentially, this is what, you know, we've been telling this to clients for sort of 6 months now. Essentially, policy becomes asymmetric, right? So if you envisage a situation where you're trying to grind it out, right? Your growth is too high, nominal GDP is too high, inflation's too high, unemployment's too low. If the data surprises to the top side, you tighten policy yet again. If the data weakens, that's what you want, right?
Exactly.
That is what you're trying to achieve. So you don't ease to offset that. You embrace it, right? So essentially, you're going to have a Fed that's going to be quick to shoot to the top side and slow to ease. They want the weakness, right? They have a 1.2 from this point where we are now, 1.2% rise in unemployment penciled in for this fucking year.
Yeah.
Right? They have it penciled in, and they're not cutting rates, and even in that scenario, until next year. Right? We've got into this mentality, Grant, that central banks are your friend, right? They're there to print money, to enable you to make money, to fund the bigger house, to do all of these things. And I always kept saying, you know, this is one of the disagreements that I had with some of my peers. You know, people were like, oh, you know, the equity market will go to hell in a handbasket when the economy rolls over. And I'm like, no. The big challenge for all of us is going to be when you get strength, not weakness. The big challenge is strength, particularly in, you know, in with inflation. And this is the other thing that people don't get, right? I mean, we just had nominal GDP, according to my models, will bounce again next quarter, and they'll probably put us around, you know, 8.5%, right? We're not a bloody emerging market, right? I mean, 8.5% is double anything seen in the last decade, and a good 30% higher than we saw at the highs of 06 or the highs of 2000, right? So we're still running way too high. And the bulls will go, okay, yeah, but, you know, it's not about nominal GDP. Who cares about nominal GDP? You know, it's all about inflation. So, and I go, so let's play this little exercise, right? Normal GDP is 8.5, right? Now, that's pretty much a function of what's going on in the labor market, how strong the labor market, but let's just say 8.5. And inflation comes in tomorrow as headline inflation drops to 0. I say to them, so that's good, is it? And they go, well, yeah, you know, inflation's gone, right? The Fed can back off. And I'm like, how? Because real growth accelerates to 8.5. And how do you do that with 3.4% unemployment without stoking the shit out of wages, right? Yeah. Which is going to drive through to your core inflation and your nominal GDP again. And this is why I say to people, there is a reason when you look at the SEPs that the Fed has this bizarre setup in their SEPs, right? Their central, you know, forecasts. And that is where they see inflation coming down quite a lot. They see unemployment rising quite a lot, 1.2%, right? And yet they see no recession. And this is because that combo is historically nigh on impossible. We've already talked about you're going to need a recession to bring the inflation down, almost certainly. There's never in the post-war period been a rise of unemployment above 0.6 in absolute terms that hasn't given you a recession, let alone 1.2.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So there's an inconsistency here, and you go, why? And because they're a political institution, right? They can't tell you, yeah, we're going to, they can't do a Bailey where they say, you're going to have the worst recession in the post-war period. And it's got unemployment's going to be really bloody high because Congress would whip them a new one, right? Yeah. So there's all this kind of obfuscation. But the true intention of the Fed is to break the back of the labor market, and they have to break the back of the labor market so that if inflation does drop, it's part of a decline in nominal GDP and real growth just doesn't immediately reaccelerate again, right? And as I said, I'm increasingly the opinion that we're in this sort of window where everyone's looking around and going, well, the grenade just went off. I'm actually okay. And it's like that, you know, that scene in Hamburger Hill where the guy's still on the radio, right? And then he looks down and goes, oh, shit. Yeah. I think we're forgetting that monetary policy works with a lag and this stuff has yet to truly bite. And I accept there's more fiscal spending than there was in the past. I accept that, you know, people have disposable income still to some degree. Although I think it's interesting, Grant, when you start to look at the returns now of, you know, of some of these companies, the revenue numbers are okay, right? So I think it was Procter & Gamble. Revenue was up 7%. Volume was down 3%. And what enabled revenue to be up 7% was a 10% increase in price.
Yeah.
Now, that's fine for Procter & Gamble to a point. The problem is falling volume determines production, and production determines employment and all those other metrics. So you can't live at some point, if that volume keeps falling, you're going to start laying people off, right? You're going to start cutting production. And that's what will drop, even if that revenue number is obfuscating things, you're going to drive us into a recession. And I think that's what's coming. The timing is tough. That's why, you know, I'm looking at Sweden going, you know, because it's a great little canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, the obvious other canary in the coal mine is Japan, you know, and they're one of the big boys, but they're in a very, very different situation to everybody else. However, they're the first ones who are being forced into doing things by the markets, as I can see. You know, this experiment with yield curve control is wobbling dramatically. We've got Ueda-san coming in to replace Kuroda-san. You know, the opportunity to finally kitchen sink this whole thing is right there if they want to take it. What do you make of the situation that they're in and the difference that Kuroda stepping aside and Ueda-san coming in might make to the way they conduct monetary policy?
So that shows some extraordinary good sources in Japan. I won't go into the deets, but I do. And I think my sense is, look, Ueda is a very, very conservative individual, highly logical thinking, argues both sides of the fence, rational individual who fundamentally believes that policy really shouldn't move much at all. Interest rates really shouldn't move much at all. So I think the idea of something very dramatic, I think we should forget, Grant. That doesn't mean that they won't do something. Now, I think there's a window where he doesn't have to move because I think inflation is coming down quite sharply. So we saw last night Tokyo inflation drop pretty materially. And I think it'll drop another 100 basis points. So I think we'll come all the way back from fours into the low twos. And I think that gives him kind of 6 months or so at least to kind of mess around with the policy. But there is no question that, interestingly, there's quite a lot of external pressure being placed on the BOJ by the ECB and by the Fed. And in part, they want the Japanese to step back from the ultra-easy policy, which is in part flooding into their markets and raising the odds that they're going to have to go too far to slow their economies down and deliver a hard landing. So there's a bit of peer pressure going on here. And while in the past you might have dismissed it, it's coming at a time when Western cohesion geopolitically has to be essential. So there are big boy games going on here, which we haven't seen really since the late 80s and the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Grant, where since then we got so used to sort of laissez-faire economics where the market determines what happens in the world, right? You know, where Elon Musk believes and Coca-Cola and whoever or Nike believes it's their inexorable right to export their production to the lowest cost producer, even if ultimately that lowest cost producer is an enemy, right? And yet, if you'd have turned to Ford in 1988 and said, you know, oh, we want you to go and set up a factory in the USSR, and we want you to give them all your technology, they'd have looked at you like you had two bloody heads, right?
Yeah.
In those days, government used to go, no, right? No. There's no fucking way you, I don't care how much money you would make.
Yeah.
You are not doing this, right? I'm the man, right? And you're going to do as you're told. And I think it's interesting to see with Japan that those big boy pressures are starting to reemerge. And so one of the objectives, I think, is the re-onshoring of Japanese production, which is currently in China, back into Japan. And that's going to require quite a lot of money. And that requires attracting that money back home. That's going to require slightly higher rates to bring some of that money onshore. But given how important Japanese money is in global fixed income markets and global equity markets, you don't want to do it too quick, right? You just... So I think that UEDA will move gradually away from where we are now with respect, you know, essentially yield curve control. But it'll be very gradual, and it'll be take a step, look around, what have we done to change flows globally, and see if there's any discourse. So, you know, it's changing ground, but I think it's going to be very, very gradual. I'm actually more concerned about the impact short-term of Europe on global flows than I am Japan. And no one's watching Europe. But
let's come back to Europe in a second. I just want to continue on Japan for a second, because I'm interested in how they do this gradually. Because, again, this is one of the great setups, if you're a trader, of my career, right? If the Japanese yield curve goes, if they do away with it, you've got an asset that is priced so far from fair value at the moment, and it's a one-way trade that you can make an awful lot of money on, right, both in the bond side and in the currency side. Yeah. And I just wonder how you can move away from that gradually, because if it becomes even slightly obvious, you know, they've kind of moved one step away from it a little bit, and we saw what happened to the yen. If they move away from it again, I've got to think the market's going to go, all right, here we go. And as you say, these are big boy gains, but this is big boy money to be made on the other side, yeah, of everything the Bank of Japan's done.
And I think there is, and I think there is money to be made from it. And, you know, it reminded me of, because you and I are both old enough to remember this, remember in the ERM crisis in Europe in like 92, yep, 93, you know, you had, you know, like the Italians would let the peg go a little bit, and then the market would go, right, now I've got you. Right? And you got the big move then after that. Now, I think, I think UEDA's lucked out, because I think we're hitting peak inflation right here, right now. And so I would be taking a step back and biding my time. But I do think there is consistent money to be made. But this is quite a managed market, Grant. You can make money. Is it going to be the big JGB yields? We walk in one day and they're, you know, 125 basis points. I don't think so, mate. I don't think so. I'm partly cynical as well that they're going to manage to sustain wage pressure, right? I think there is, you know, I've looked at Japanese wages, and, you know, we write a lot about Japan because we've got this Japan update, which we put out, and Jeff is,
yeah,
who wrote to me, you know, he's beyond a fluent Japanese speaker. And the reality of the situation is we've got pretty sharp jump in wages. There's a lot of pressure on Japanese corporates to raise wages. It's never been sustained in the last 40 years. So fingers crossed, we'll see. I'm sort of in the camp that if you actually start to raise bond yields in Japan, actually it's a positive, because it will encourage spending, because they have got a lot of retirees and that income's kind of important to them.
Yeah.
But I do think it will be, it's not to me the immediate risk. And because it's being watched by policymakers, I know that BOJ, ECB and Fed are all talking because they're all worried about this.
Yeah.
Because of that, Grant, I suspect that's not the black swan. It never is.
Okay. But you don't think that this move to re-onshore production away from China, that doesn't exacerbate this wages problem and maybe keep it a problem for longer?
Yeah, and maybe it does. But as I said, I think it's gradual. I think they'll want to keep the yen in kind of a sweet spot where it's a little weak, to just encourage it's cheap, you know, bring stuff back onshore. Yeah. But it's not too weak.
Okay. Well, let's finish with Europe then, and talk a little bit about why you think that Europe is perhaps more of a concern than Japan, because that's, again, that's counter consensus.
It goes back to this sort of fundamental concern that I have, that there is a inordinately large carry trade at the center of global markets. And it's, we've done this one before, right? You spend obviously lots of time in Australia. And if you remember from 2009, really to 2011, 2012, there was a perfect Soros-esque reflexive cycle in Australia. And to explain to people, reflexivity, as Soros described it, is basically the purchasing of an asset drives the fundamentals that underpin the asset itself. So the actual purchase of the asset reinforces the fundamentals supporting that purchase, and it becomes virtuous, right? The problem is with reflexive cycles, they can become vicious, right? They can be nice on the way up and bad on the way up. So in Australia, what happened was we get the global financial crisis. Australia should have got absolutely tarred and feathered, right? Because it's the raw material producer. The raw material producer typically gets has the most volatility. If you think of the head and the tail of a dog, right? The consumer's the head. It doesn't move that much. The tail's like, whoa, like this, right? But it didn't, because it got bailed out by the monetary stimulus from the US and the fiscal stimulus from China. And all of a sudden, we're looking at the Aussie in the summer of 09, and it's starting to pick up, and all this spending is coming through, and all these orders are coming through. All of a sudden, it just powers up. And as it powers up, all this money piles into Australia, right? The Aussie banks start funding themselves with offshore funding. That goes into the housing market. The commodity market's booming. The RBA looks at this. They start raising rates. Right, the Aussie goes up even more money piles in, right? The Aussie banks borrow even more. They lend it to the domestics, who buy even more bloody houses at stupid, ridiculous rates, right? And the whole thing just becomes whoosh until it isn't in 2011 and it goes to hell in a handbasket, right? So then you look at what's happened. That's a small reflexive bubble. The big one always centers around the dollar. Yeah. And the dollar has basically been in an uptrend since 2011, but really since 2014, okay? And starting in 2014, as Janet Yellen started to talk about tightening and what have you, the dollar started its uptrend. And that has sucked in an enormous amount of money into the US economy. And it went into, you know, firstly, as a foreigner, you want to be long dollars because the dollar's going up. And then you go, I'm long dollars. What do I do with them? Oh, let me buy some corporate debt because that's yielding more than I can get back home. What do the corporates do with that money? They take it and they buy back stock. And then the US equity market starts outperforming. And you go, oh, foreigner, let me buy some US equities. So US equities go up. And then because of the wealth effect that spins off from that, the US economy starts to boom and the current account deficit starts to rise. And the US needs money to fund that current account deficit. And the Fed's raising rates and more money's coming in, and it all becomes like this. We've been here before. We were here in 2000, the dot-com bubble. We were here in 2008, where Johnny Foreigner has funded an expansion in the US and he's funding a large current account deficit. So this relationship can keep going for a long, long time, Grant. It can become truly reflexive.
Yeah.
But it is, by definition, a sort of unstable, stable equilibrium, because it's a three-legged stool. And any one of these three legs that go, the whole thing can unwind and unwind quite significantly. The first thing that can happen is the dollar can fall, because definitionally the flow that's come in to fund that current account deficit that the US is running has to be unhedged. Okay, can't be hedged currency inflow. So it's really, and this is where it comes back to Europe, it's really a lot of European money in particular and some Japanese money that's gone into the US to fund the deficit. Now, it hasn't gone into bonds because we've seen what they've been doing with treasuries. It's gone into equities, is what happened during the dot-com bubble. In 2008, 2009, it went into housing-related debt.
Yep.
So you've got a lot of unhedged foreign money in the US. The second thing that can happen is the value of the assets that they own could fall. So we could just turn around and we could find, fuck me, the US equity market really is a bubble like it was in 2000. And suddenly the value of those assets goes down. And then Johnny Foreigner goes, oh, my NASDAQ in Europe's not performing, right? Option number three, we can go into a deep recession. The current account deficit can shrink. And definitionally, we don't need the money anymore. And the money goes down. And all of those things can continue. And there's, when you look at Europe, maybe what's going to happen is we're already starting to see, and I've been amazed in the nature of this correction, but, you know, we flagged in January a whole bunch of charts that were just structurally breaking down. When you looked at the performance of the Euro stocks versus the S&P in Euro. So a European investor who's put money into the US equity market, unhedged to fund that current account deficit, suddenly his returns are deteriorating in Euro terms relative to being domestically invested. So that maybe that is starting to happen. And if you look at the flows, if you look at flows overnight versus during the cash session in the US, certainly since November, the US has been the buyer of stocks and everyone in the overnight session is selling them, right? So that, I think, trend is picking up. Europe's going to need a shitload of money, Grant. I mean, I was reading this article just to hit the climate change objective of Germany over the next 3 years, I think it was, €1 trillion, let alone the defense spending, right? Where's that money coming from? Well, they aren't going to be printing it because they've got high inflation. So it has to come back from where it is. So it comes back from the US. So I think there is this very unstable equilibrium that revolves around these flows that have funded a US current account deficit that have heavily come from Europe. And I look at this and I go, the best get out of jail free card for the US would be a swinging recession in Europe, maybe to do with the, you know, the energy shock, but we seem to have dodged that bullet for now. And I'm not saying that I'm uber bullish on Europe because I think there are some big worries. But if the US starts to go into a recession and that money starts to go home, then my longer term models tell me the real value for the euro should be 140.
Wow. Okay.
Right? Not 110.
Yeah.
108 or 106, right? So I think this relative performance game is really an interesting one. And I think we forget that really, you know, if I look at the world and you ask me, do I think the next 10 years in the equity market are going to look like the last 10 years, where the only place to put your money was the NASDAQ in dollar terms, where the returns for the NASDAQ from the lows, if you look at the high, it was up 1,350%. It's still up 1,000%.
Yeah.
The returns on the IBEX, so the Spanish market, were down, zero. So do I think the next 10 years are going to look exactly the same, where the NASDAQ makes you 1,000% and you lose money in the IBEX? And the answer is no fucking way. One of my favorite trades is short NASDAQ, long IBEX.
Well, but yeah, right. With a handful of Swedish rates trades thrown in just to stabilize the portfolio. Well, no, but it's interesting, right? Because this is where a lot of people I'm speaking to, this is where their head's at. It's now about relative trades, as you said. And we've had this huge tailwind that's taken certain things on a one-way ride to the stars. And suddenly, you've got some phenomenal hedges if you want to take the other side of those trades, right? And they're everywhere, as you say, they're everywhere. Who would think to look at the Spanish index?
Right.
But you can argue, look at the French index, you'll probably find a similar situation. You can probably look at the FTSE. It won't be quite as...
Well, it's not quite as attractive, but it's still pretty
But it's still... Good. Yeah, and suddenly there are so many ways that you can maintain exposure, whether it be to equities, to commodities, to whatever you want, and you can find someone on the other side of it that will just dampen the chance of you being wrong.
Yeah. I mean, we've got rate trades. I mean, it's, you know, you look at this inversion in the yield curve that you've got with these assumed rate cuts, and it's giving you opportunities, Grant, which you've never really get. I mean, you know, if I said to you, look, you know, I think that the S&P could be at 5,000 and it could be at 3,000, then you go and buy those options and it'd be bloody expensive. But you can basically put that bet on in the interest rate market for not a lot, because this sort of assumed rates go up and then they get cut really hard is sort of pricing that in, because either one or two things will happen. If the market goes to 5,000, those cuts aren't going to happen. So that curve will, you know, which is doing this, will do this best.
Yeah, exactly.
Because rates in 2024 and 25 will have to rise. And if the S&P drops to 3,000, then those hikes, we won't stay there very long. We will, you know, this thing will collapse, you know, so early 24 will end up collapsing. So I think there's all sorts of macro trades out there that are really, really very, very attractive. We haven't, to your point, you know, you don't get those very often in your career where you get given the those 10 delta, 20 delta options for nothing. You usually pay out the yin yang for those.
Well, and of course, the other, I think the really important part of this is it reinforces this change of environment whereby retail investors and, you know, family offices and all these guys who've found it really easy to buy the dip or make money in one direction trades, this is going to be an incredibly lucrative environment for guys that really understand the rules and understand all the different options available to them. But for the people who have been presented with a very limited set of options that have all worked for a long, long time, this environment is going to be utterly treacherous.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a client who's truly sort of blue blood British wealth manager, right? I mean, I'm sure they've got royals money and they're all the most pucker chaps and they're lovely. And they always wear suits, right? Always wear suits. And you would think that they were the most conservative long-term investor. They are some of the most aggressive guys. And they think that we are going to go into a period of increased volatility where essentially you are going to have to go from owning no bonds to all bonds to no duration stocks to all duration stocks. And the speed, you know, if you think of the efficient frontier investment, you know, curve at 45 degrees, it's going to go here to here to here to here to here, right? And passive, if that's right, and it's not, look, we're not quite there yet. We're going to need steps. We're going to need the central banks to be forced to give up on this inflation fight so the inflation truly isn't wrung out. It becomes embedded. And how do you do that? You have to have the deep recession, then you have to have the political pressure, you have to have rising unemployment, you have to have all of those things to get you to that point. And the gun gets put to their head and they're like, oh, can I do a Volcker? No, I can't, right? But if you get to that, and that's kind of my gut where we will get, Grant, and then you throw the geopolitics in and you throw the deglobalization and all of that stuff, boy, macro is back, mate. I just hope that we can hang on long enough as old gits to put our experience to use.
Look, you and I are going to be taken out behind the knackers yard shed and shot at some point.
Turned into glue.
Yeah, exactly right. But maybe not quite yet. We're still kicking and screaming. Well, listen, Julian, it's been a phenomenal, hour and change now. That flew by. I'm so glad you had the time to do this. Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. And for people listening that don't know how to follow your phenomenal work that you and Harry do, just let them know how they can do that, because I think there'll be plenty of people after this conversation that, if they weren't familiar with you, will want to be a lot more familiar with you.
Well, thanks, mate. So, look, if you want to just sort of get involved in the whole baiting and some, you know, constructive comments, but I do throw it out there just to bait once in a while, you can follow me on Twitter at JulianMI2. If you're interested in the product, and we've obviously got the product with Raoul from Macro Insiders, which is sort of more retail, you know, you get Raoul's stuff as well, or indeed the institutional product, which is all ours. And then contact support at mi2partners.com.
There we go. Nice and simple. Mate, you're looking well. I don't know where I'll find you in the world next time we speak. Who knows where you've moved to then, but I hope you stay one step ahead of whoever it is that's following you and enjoy the rest of the summer. And hopefully we'll get together at some point up there in the Northeast.
Perfect, mate. Thank you very much.
All right, mate. Take care. Thanks, Julian.
Cheers.
Well, I promised you a fascinating conversation. And as always, Julian delivered in spades there. You know, the work that Julian and Harry do at MI2 Partners is absolutely phenomenal. It really is best in breed. So I would encourage you to visit the website, to email them, support at MI2 Partners, and find out about what they're doing, see whether it's suitable for you, because It really is, as I said, best in breed. That's it from me for another episode. I'll be back again shortly. In the meantime, I thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.